It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome to another BritFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest with me is writer, editor, publisher James Brown. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Stuart. Thanks for having me.
We've come together because you've got a book out, your memoir, Animal House, which kind of gives us your life story, I suppose, in terms of journalism and publishing.
That's right, yeah. It's subtitled Music, Magazines and Mayhem. That's what it is.
Indeed it was. And just for the listener, I'm up to the intermission, which is a fitting point. As I think we're just moving into the loaded period, I think.
I think I had so many great times when I was writing on when I was a music writer on Sounds and then NME. And then went off and managed a band for a bit. And then I started Loaded. And so they're all heavily covered in the book. I actually took an awful lot of the music stories out. I held them back because there were just too many dressing rooms, too many interviews, too many places to include them all and be able to get the other things that the publishers wanted me to write about, which was some of the more personal things.
Yeah. Because I was going to say that's the big learning point for me. You know, obviously knowing you as a byline and knowing you as the person that gave us Loaded magazine. But then to read about your own background and family life and stuff, I wasn't expecting that.
No, well, I think a lot of people have been surprised by the book, and because some people, I think, just thought it would be like an edition of Loaded. Hmm. But you know, I spend more time on the NME than I did on Loaded.
Is that right?
And so I think it was important to explain why I was like I was on the NME. You know, I was traveling fast. I was ambitious. I was unhappy with where I was when I was leaving Leeds. And I just wanted something better and different. And so in the book, I kind of give some background as to what my personal situation was. And it's really, I think putting the more personal things in, like, you know, what it was like growing up with somebody who was ill, very badly ill on and off, which ultimately led to their death. Mm. And then also later, coming out of my early 30s, you know, when I had to stop drinking and taking drugs.
Yeah.
Writing about that period was important to me because it was just, you know, exploring and explaining the consequence of the behavior that I'd lived throughout my 20s. Those things surprised people, and I think that also has been having that balanced up with the kind of the hijinks of Loaded and all the interesting musicians that I hung out with has made it a fuller book.
Mm.
And that's what the reviewers and the interviewers and also the publishers felt. I struggled at times to think that people would want to hear what it was like being on the road with you too, or the Happy Mondays. and then be reading about, you know, my mom, you know, my mom's death and things like that. So, but, you know, the response has been really phenomenal. You know, I've had a really good response from readers. Obviously, you can speak to people all the time now through Twitter and Instagram and so on.
Yeah.
And I've had a lot of private letters and messages, you know, I say letters, you know, private messages on social media platforms of people opening up about challenges that they've had in their family growing up. So that's been touching. I didn't expect that at all. I was hoping that maybe the writing about the drug recovery might help a few people, but I hadn't anticipated sharing the sort of family difficulties would kind of strike a chord with other people.
I mean, but like you say in the book yourself, you're basically sort of running yourself ragged with the writing side of things, and that thing you've always wished to do, and this is the backdrop this is the background to what you're not talking about. So how people are finding it.
When I was at the NME, I was pretty punchy, you know. I kind of drank a lot. I didn't ever relax, really. I suppose I didn't really know how to go on holiday until I was in my early 30s. You know, when I was on the NME, my idea of a holiday was just going to New York and LA and hanging around like I was on a tour with a band.
Well, I must admit, I mean, from a journalist's point of view, it's really impressive to read, like, and I went there on my own dime. And I went there on my own dime. You know, you went looking for the story as opposed to just the normal kind of junket thing, which obviously would have been common as well. But
But I think I was very driven, you know, because in 1983, 84 in Leeds, when I was leaving school, there genuinely wasn't anything going on. I mean, it's hard to explain it to the kind of internet generation. No Google, no WhatsApp, no Spotify, no, you know, YouTube, nothing, no eBay, no way to interact with other people other than meeting them in the pub or meeting them, you know, at gigs or in record shops. So you kind of, now people are driven together by the opportunity to communicate socially. But in those days I had mates that I just met hanging around in Jumbo Records.
Yeah.
People that I would see at gigs. I used to see a lot of the students that would be at the same gigs where I was selling my fanzine. But a lot of my friends at school who I played football with or went to gigs with, as I got older, they were less interested in going to gigs. And so I was pretty much, I was on my own quite a lot, you know. And then I'd kind of like, I joined this network of underground fanzine writers, which spread from, Greenock, west of Glasgow to where else? Hull, Manchester, Liverpool, London. And so I just found myself heading off, to answer your question. At that age of 18 and 19, I was just hitchhiking out of Leeds and I'd go to the Unity Club in Hull or I got a Big Flames Wild Club in Manchester to see the bands I had on and sell my fanzines. So the idea of just heading off to go and find the Beastie Boys in Switzerland when everybody wanted to find out about them was just exactly the same to me as seeing the Redskins were playing in Nottingham and going and hitchhiking there and making sure I got there in time, you know, for the sound check so they'd put me on the guest list. I mean, even phones in those days, if you rang somebody and they weren't in, that was it.
I posted on Facebook that I was reading your book and how much I was enjoying it. And a friend of mine wrote, and I think you might like this as a response. He said, back when he was a mouthy teenage fanzine editor running Attack on Bezag, I came very close to giving him a smack in the mouth. Can't even remember why now, but I suspect that probably happened to him a lot back then. He did have a skill for irking people. And then he said, fair play to him though, he got to live the dream.
I was pretty obnoxious.
But no, that's part of this. I mean, I said to him, I said, I think he's pretty much aware of what he was like then from the book.
No, but I talk about that in the book. You know, I'm very honest about my own shortcomings. I was really pushy and mouthy. But you know what? If I hadn't sold the fanzines, I wouldn't have eaten. I was on 14 quid a week on the dole. This was before I started writing for Sounds. When I just had my fanzines between leaving school and starting to write for Sounds like 18 months or 2 years later. Yeah. I mean, I literally, like, it was skint. It wasn't like I didn't have rich parents. Mm. I didn't have a sort of a an inheritance, or, you know, sometimes I meet these people in London and they talk about they haven't got any money, and it's like, next thing you know, they're putting a zinc roof on the house, you know. So I think, yeah, I was really, I was obnoxious. I was full of myself and I was obnoxious and I was pushy, but also that's what I was drawn to the NME, that I realised reading the NME that there were a lot of people that were like that in there. And so that really became the kind of the spotlight I was aiming for, you know, that not the spotlight, you know, the lighthouse of,
yeah,
you know, the beam that was drawing me in. And so once I got to NME, where you could be like that and be celebrated for it, coupled with the fact that I was good at spotting new bands, and then I was also good at spotting other good new writers, it meant that I was in a place where I could progress and start to get a life, you know.
No, and to be honest with you, not to get too sort of dewy-eyed and romantic about it, but it is refreshing to read a sort of working-class success story in the media. You know, there aren't loads of them, you know, and it's great to see.
Yeah, someone posh will play me in the film.
Well, I was going to ask you that question. I mean, Caitlin Moran's book, you know, How to Build a Girl, got made into a film, and we're obviously a film podcast.
Yeah, we've had some offers already, you know.
Some really? Oh, exciting.
So TV series and films and things like that. So we've got a few different people have approached us about that.
Nice one. Well, look, a question I ask a lot of documentarians about when they make a documentary is about perception versus what the reality was when they've made what they perceive to be going into the film, and then what happens when they've made the film. Now, when you set about writing a book about yourself, you might have had a perception about how that story might have panned out, but what do you think you learned about yourself that you wouldn't have perceived at the start of the writing of the book?
Well, that's a good question, Stuart, because there were two or three times when I realised, when I literally asked myself, why am I writing this? One time I actually wrote down, and there were things that I writing it out, I got some perspective. So I was writing about having an eating disorder, and I remember thinking, nobody cares about this. No one will care about having... I mean, it wasn't... In those days, in the late 60s and early 70s, nobody said, oh, you've got an eating disorder. You need to go to some sort of therapist and deal with it, or some dietitian or something. But what I realised was that because I didn't eat properly throughout my childhood, I mainly just lived off sweets and white bread and crisps and chips. I was terrified of going in for the school lunches early when I first went to school. I wouldn't even eat the puddings, you know. I was just terrified of eating. But when I was writing it, I realised that actually that's probably the reason why I later became a really excessive drinker and drug user, because I didn't have any understanding of structure and balance, you know, about when and why. So that was one element. Okay. And then the other thing, when I was writing about when we went on these, we used to have this, I went to a middle school, I think some cities in England sort of copied the American way to break up the gap between primary school and secondary school. And we had a head teacher at middle school, and she was into folk dancing, and she used to train all the kids. So the girls would do Irish dancing and Scottish dancing, and she'd have the boys doing Morris dancing and sword dancing. And she used to train us up and then take us on a coach to Germany. So I was writing about that just because it was, and then I said, what is the point of writing about this? And I realized that's why I have itchy feet now to this day. You know, I think that, you know, that by the time I was 12, I'd been abroad on a coach, basically on tour four times.
Yeah.
And so that idea of getting in a van with a band and going to a gig and a performance, that was already in there from when I, you know, when I saw those pictures of the Two Tone tours or the Sex Pistols and the Clash on buses, when they were trying to, you know, replicate the old 60s kind of like multiple band lineup. Just looked like the school trips we went on those tours. And then later, when I was good at football, the school team went to Belgium to play some teams on some tournaments there, again on coaches. And I think those coach trips were probably in an early life were what set me up to be so keen to head off on the road rather than just doing what most people did, which was get the single, get the album, watch the band when they come through town.
Mm.
I wanted to go with the bands. I wanted to travel with them and get away from where I was in Leeds and go to different places, but mainly because the high of the music was just so exhilarating, the bands that I loved. And so they were a couple of things that when I was writing them, I was thinking, I was learning things, I was realizing things about my life. Because I had to ask myself, why am I putting this in? Surely somebody will just want to know what it was like working at, you know, meeting Jack Nicholson when I, you know, or hanging around with, you know, Paul Weller or stuff like that.
Yeah.
Will they really give a fuck about this? But also I liked writing about my childhood. I knew that when I wrote my football book, which did pretty well, Above Head High, about playing football, I knew that people really liked the stuff that I'd written about playing football in the streets in Headingley. And lots of people, like an awful lot of people, wrote to me on Twitter talking about identification. And so I wanted to revisit some of that. I like writing about it. You know, I basically had, largely, apart from some issues, I had an enjoyable childhood. And then suddenly when I was 15, 16, you know, my mum was ill, unemployment was looming, they'd just caught the Yorkshire Ripper, and that's where I lived, where some of his attacks took place.
It was really weird reading that chapter, because I'll not kid you, I was going, is he going to mention the Yorkshire Ripper? And it was on, because like I knew what the years were from what you dated it, and then suddenly you kind of, it comes into the story. And I did wonder if you were going to go into that.
I mean, anybody who was whatever age they were in Leeds growing up in that time, and maybe, you know, Bradford, and he struck in Preston as well, maybe Sheffield, but particularly Leeds, it was terrifying. It was like, it made you paranoid and worried, and worried for your family, for your mum, your sisters, or whoever, you know, people particularly who had adult, you know, women in the family. And it was a really, I wrote a long piece about it for a little independent crime magazine. And that's what some of that in the book came out of, that bigger piece.
Yeah.
Because it definitely affected my mum's sort of mental well-being. And I mean, it was just so close. You know,
course,
I mean,
yeah, when you were talking about on your, like the street, like streets and neighbouring streets, that is close.
Yeah, but I mean, he attacked a woman that was staying at my girlfriend's house.
Jeez, yeah.
You know, and he killed, I think the first woman he killed, he left her on the playing field where I used to play table tennis. You know, me and my mate, I mean, there were different times.
My
mate would be like, you know, 10 years old, 11 years old, walking home from one side of Leeds from kind of like Hare Hills or Chapel Town all the way back to Headingley, you know. And I mean, the kids, I don't think kids would do that nowadays, have that sort of journey unshepherded. But obviously I'm not making some sort of claim to be close to it than, you know, than anyone else who was a citizen of Leeds at the time. But it was a really dark thing. So when you're mid-teens, just things started getting a lot darker. My mum was ill and in and out of hospital. The Ripper was leaving corpses around. Nobody knew who he was. Unemployment was looming. You know, I was one of those kids who was in the CND who thought,
I was
going to
say, it's Cold War as well. You know, it was looming, wasn't it?
It was dark. It was a dark time. And I think, and I suppose the other thing that I realised when I was writing the book was, in a way, Loaded was recapturing that, where that childhood ended, perhaps a bit prematurely. And so that on the first part, in the first chapter, you know, the very introduction, it says this is a book about two childhoods, because Loaded was like a childhood. It was just fantastic. It was sometimes childish, it was often childlike.
Yeah.
And it was just a gang of young guys largely having a fucking great time. And you know, when you're a kid, your mates would knock on your door and saying you're coming to play out, you know, go on your bikes or play football or make swings in the woods or whatever, build dens. That's basically what we did every day and got paid for it, you know, and it was a success. You know, people enjoyed.
The one article that never loses my mind is the fact you got into Milan into jet fighter planes.
Well, actually that was, it was Sampdoria.
Sampdoria,
we just found those. There were there were two Italian magazines. One was called King, and I can't remember what the other one was. And they were really unusual magazines because they were very mainstream magazines, but they'd also occasionally have like topless women in it, or you know, like, you know, those Italian fashion shoots would be so hot. You know, and at that time, you know, they didn't have Des Lynam. They'd have some beautiful model presenting Serie A football. So it was, you know, much more, and we just saw the pictures in there. I found this magazine, and there was a really good magazine shop in Old Compton Street. And you could go in there and they had magazines from all over the world. And so we found these magazines, and there were just these pictures in there of Ruud Gullit and David Platt and Roberto Mancini, Lombardo. Sven-Göran Eriksson was the manager, and they looked great. And Tim, who was my assistant editor, he got on the phone and found the guy who'd organised it and did an interview with him. And it was for a charity calendar.
Oh, wow.
Every day they did a fancy charity calendar and some posters to raise money for a charity that this guy ran a clothes shop. So it was really good, though, because it showed that the very first Loaded, it showed that we were going to do different things.
Mm.
You know, we had a few real points of difference in that first issue that other magazines didn't have. So the readers, when they found it, suddenly went, oh, this is, I like this, this is me, and I've never seen this stuff before.
Yeah, because my love affair with magazines began with, do you remember LM magazine?
No.
It was kind of music and politics.
I don't remember it.
And I used to get that, and that was kind of, and then it wasn't till, because then Loaded comes along, and suddenly music, film, football, as being like, this is what we do. And it was like, thank God, somebody's finally acknowledged that we do like it, and it's not a bad thing.
Well, that was why it was a success, because it was how guys were.
Hmm.
The magazines that had come before it were very, I mean, if I picked up a GQ, which I never did, but I remember seeing one, it had like Michael Heseltine on the cover, and like the fashion shoot had, I mean, all things that later kind of became coolly aspirational, but you know, like it would be some country squire in his barber wellies and in his barber coat and his hunter wellies and his shotgun and a brace of pheasants over the Range Rover, you know, that it was just a different world. You know, I was more like to see somebody wearing a donkey jacket than a kind of a squire's outfit, you know. So there was a very open goal, really, I felt, when they offered me the chance to create the magazine, was if I mix music and football, which funnily enough, the publishers who published it, that's what they had. They had Loaded. Before Loaded, they had Shoot magazine, they had 90 Minutes magazine, and they had Enemy and Melody Maker and Vox. So it wasn't that far of a stretch to mix the two things. And I used the, you know, for all the Loaded photo content came from Shoot. You know, I used to go up into their photo library, and it was absolutely fascinating. I mean, I knew the Enemy photo library inside out. But I would be finding photos in the Shoot library that had never been used. I found an amazing one of George Best running in the rain, playing for Northern Ireland, which we did as a full-page, three-panel gatefold poster to pull out of Loaded. It was brilliant. And you knew if it had ever been used, because on the back there would be lines with numbers on them, which would be messages to the printers telling them what size they wanted the picture, or it might be there might be a crop around it. There might be pieces of paper stuck on the front to illustrate what they wanted cropping out. And yeah, so a lot of footballing nostalgia in Loaded for the 70s and 80s came from the Shoot archive. Like I said, it just felt like an open landscape. You know, I knew we were never short of things to write about in Loaded.
No, and it's like you said before about there being no internet and all that kind of thing. It's like magazines, certainly from a consumer point of view, where I was looking at it from, were like this curated landscape of what's going on. So the more interesting and more diverse the offerings were, but the more you could relate to them at the same time, because they seemed connected, was what was the fun part of finding a magazine like Loaded.
But also, I think if you think about what we're going to come on to talk about, football was prevalent by 1994 when Loaded came out. I mean, I came up with the idea in 92, and it took about 18 months to get the publishers to agree to launch it. But by then, football was everywhere. You could watch football regularly on Sky. And
yeah, Italia 90 had happened, hadn't it?
Yeah, but it was, I mean, people talk about Italia 90 because England had a good tournament. The first time they had a good tournament, really. Well, I mean, Lineker did well in 86, but it was the first time we'd got to semi-final since 66, I think. So yeah, yeah. It was first really relatively successful tournament in 20 years. But Sky putting football on television changed everything, because suddenly it wasn't just on for an hour every now and then. There were two or three shows a week. But what wasn't given the same prominence was films. There were no Sky movies at that point. So you had to get to get cult films, you had to find either a video shop that had somebody who was selecting good old films, or the first videos that I owned was when I was on the NME. When I started earning a bit of cash, there was a shop at the bottom of Tottenham Court Road, just where it meets Oxford Street, which was where the NME offices were very close to.
Right by Centre Point.
Yeah, so diagonally opposite Centre Point, heading north, there was a pub called the Blue Posts, and there was this little array of quite shabby-looking shops. I think there's like a Marks and Spencers or something there now. They rebuilt it, and they would sell things like, just before where all of the... this Tottenham Court Road is where you used to go to get your Walkmans to interview bands, and people would get the sound systems. And there was this little of shoddy shops. They sold things like secondhand instruments, and there was one, there was a video shop there, and it was such a fucking great shop. Whoever chose the films. So when I got my first wages from the NME, I went and bought Electric Light in Blue, Mean Streets, Taxi Driver, With Nail, The Eagle Has Landed. I remember buying about five or six films, and they were my videos. Animal House. So the films I'm going to talk about were you today.
I was going to say, let's not leave that in the locker room. I'm going to introduce the format now. So we're going to do three films that impacted everything in your adult life. Three films that James has already given me, and we're going to talk for 5 minutes against the clock for each one. So can you hear this okay at your end when it goes off? Can you hear that?
Yes.
Starting with the first one, we've got 1978 National Lampoon's Animal House. Obviously, it's the title of your book. So where did you first see that, and why is that important to you in terms of impact on your adult life?
I must have even seen that at the cinema, which would be the Lounge in Headingley, or the Cottage Road Cinema in Headingley, which is the oldest cinema in Leeds, or possibly the Hyde Park Cinema, which is often used in period dramas. But where I mainly remember watching it is, I think my mates had a video of it. We had two films, Quadrophenia and Animal House, that would always be shown at teenage parties.
Okay.
So the year that film came out, I was 13. And so you can have a year into secondary school, old teachers, big old building, people, you know, just, it's kind of weird, just at the same time as you're starting to kind of change and explore things in life, you're getting told you've got to work harder and you've got to stop playing around, and all the things that are great about being a kid, at the same time as you start to go through puberty and kind of be, I mean, you know, you start giving all these what felt like draconian measures.
You're being warned, aren't you? Adulthood's just around the corner.
Yeah, and then so suddenly I saw this film about these Americans and what?
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Funny enough, because I grew up in the student area of Leeds, I never associated the students that would piss in our garden or nick milk or leave a, you know, nick your bikes or whatever with, or just would kind of ruin the pub when I was a bit older. I never associated them with the students that were in Animal House. It was just an explosion of fun and stupidity. It was very well written. It was very funny. There were so many good scenes in it. Obviously, Belushi steals the whole film. It's his film, you know, one of only two good films he really made. And so that, I just thought it looked great. I loved it. I loved the character. I loved the fact that in the face of discipline, they, instead of knuckling under, they just got worse. And I love the fact that they won. I love the fact that the students, you know, the Delta Tau Chi house beat the system. And it was, so like I say, it was like a fantasy really of what life possibly could be like. But that film stayed with me throughout my teenage years. And then when I could buy videos, I bought a video copy, you know, I bought a videotape of it. And it was totally in my mind when I was creating Loaded. More than anything else, the toga party, the drinking, the road trip, you know, just the scene when he says, "You guys have been on double secret probation." You know, I was often on double secret probation. You know, I think I'm still banned from Five Live. You know, been banned from Five Live twice. And
is it a sense though? You know, obviously as a kid, you're only getting those adult influences. Suddenly, you're seeing a film that offers you this other adult influence, where they're kind of young adults, obviously not the ones dishing out draconian things, but like that whole sense of fraternity where that fraternity could be your rebellion, really.
Well, it was a film about freedom, really. It was a film about the freedom and about possibility, and it was very funny. You know, for a 13-year-old kid, there's a couple of sexy bits in it. You know, I just thought it was, I thought they looked like they had the best life. And I'm glad Loaded was a success, you know, because I think, you know, you go through periods of fun and then you do move on and you do change. But the 3 years that I spent live at Loaded, as well as less so the year and a half we were developing it, that was kind of more about thoughts and putting ideas down on paper. But, when we were actually living the life, it was often, you know, I used to think, you know, I'd captured the dream that I've had when I was 13.
So in that sense, was it never in doubt that Animal House would be the name of the book?
Well, yeah, near the end. I mean, I didn't name it Animal House after the film. I named it because it was a film that I liked in the same way as, yeah, it was a film that I really liked, but I also thought, in all honesty, that film is very close to what it was like running Loaded. You know, being from the age, you know, I was about 27 when I came up with the idea, 29 when it came out. So probably slightly retarded, you know, I don't mean that in a negative way, slightly immature, you know,
slightly less.
You know, at the same time other people were thinking about getting married, I was thinking about like getting paid to test crisps and vodka.
Indeed.
In toga parties. And I'm actually doing a I'm doing a talk in a brewery on the 15th of December.
I have my ticket.
Brilliant, thanks. It'd be good to see you. But I thought I might do it in a toga costume. I think I will. I'm going to do that.
Okay, well, you've just recorded it. You've just recorded it on the podcast. You're going to do it.
Yeah. I'm going to put on a crown of thorns like Belushi's got in that thing. You know, I love that. I mean, the opening line in the book is the quote from, was it Over When the Germans Bombed Pearl Harbor? It was just a very funny film. It had great sense of fun and energy about it. And so that's why.
Well, look, your second choice.
Yeah.
5 minutes of long gone now.
Okay. Can I say one more thing?
Yeah, go on.
The music in Animal House is brilliant as well.
What's the standout track for you?
Well, just throughout all of it, you know, I guess, you know, all of it. It's all that old soul, all those old soul songs. Then the Kingsman, Louis Louis as well, you know.
Of course, yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, look, moving into much darker territory than Animal House, 1976's Paul Schrader written, Martin Scorsese directed, one of my favourite films, if I'm honest with you, Taxi Driver. Where does that fit in terms of your formative years and how it impacted on you?
Well, I wouldn't have seen Taxi Driver until I was older. Apart from anything else, even when I was in my early 20s, I looked about 13. You know, had a suede head and a t-shirt and a pair of shorts. And
an image you keep repeating in the book, which is quite funny. Whenever you turn up at places, you're basically this teenager adult.
Yeah, people thought I was a kid, you know. That's part of, I mean, it helped really because it's precocious, you know. But the first time I saw a picture of Travis Bickle was in the NME. And the NME, you know, was in the mid 80s, early 80s. The NME had a lot of strong film content, so you'd see things like articles about Eraserhead and Taxi Driver or Mad Max, and they'd use the imagery really big. But of course, it was very difficult to see those films if you were kind of 12, 13, 14, 15. Because one, the video world hadn't really exploded at that point, and two, you know, the films would just come through for a week and they'd be gone, you know, and if you weren't old enough to see him, it was difficult to get in. But one of the first times I remember hearing anything about Taxi Driver was when I had a mohawk myself.
Okay.
After I left school, the first thing I did was get a mohawk. It was great.
How high a mohawk did you go? Or did you just have the central thing like Travis?
No, it wasn't soaked up.
Yeah.
It was like Strummer's.
Okay.
It was shaved down the sides and across the top. And I did it when I was going on the Oxford Road show with Billy Bragg. He was hosting it and he asked me to go on and talk about my fanzine. So I would have been about 18 or something. And this guy came up to me whilst I was selling my fanzine outside a Clash gig in Leeds. And this guy came and mentioned Travis Bickle and Taxi Driver. And then when I start, I don't honestly know when I first saw it. It could have been at a cinema in London. You know, I don't think it would have been at the Pictures in Leeds. I think, and then getting the video, and it was just a film that I watched over and over and over again. When you know, that era before digital TV, you would have tapes, you know, in the same way as you would have albums and listen to them again and again. So I just thought it was a brilliantly filmed and a redemption. And that Travis Bickle goes through the love, you know. I always have had friends, and I've always had girlfriends as well. But London was a big old city when I first came to it, you know. Mm. And often, you know, when I'd come out of the NME, I didn't know a great deal of people, so I used to spend a fair bit of time walking around the city and looking at it. And obviously, I wasn't a Vietnam vet about to go on a killing. I didn't have a personal identification, but I just loved that story, and I went off and consumed everything I could find about it. You know, Schrader on Schrader, which I think Faber published, and any books that I could find about Martin Scorsese, I've got them up there on my shelf still now. I thought it was such a unique take on a guy's attempting to get accepted. And it's actually, it's got an identical plot structure to The King of Comedy, which I realised one Monday morning when I went into the NME, and I'd watched both of them back to back the night before, and I started talking about them and I was getting them confused. You know, there's basically a guy who's trying to be accepted in society or in showbiz as a king of comedy. Everybody's knocking him back, so he does something really extreme, and by doing something extreme he becomes accepted. Yeah, just I thought it was beautifully written. It looked amazing, and the Bernard Herrmann soundtrack was, you know, I bought that as well. So I would sometimes, you know, if Taxi Driver was on in Soho, they would have these sort of independent cinemas, and sometimes they'd just show films regardless of when they were released. So yeah, I would occasionally I'd go and watch it if it was on.
You ever frequent the Scala? You frequent the Scala?
Pardon?
Do you ever frequent the Scala cinema when that was still a cinema?
Yeah, I went to the Scala. Yeah, I went to Scala a few times. I saw, I think I saw Gallon Drunk once in front of, they played in front of Apocalypse Now. That was pretty good.
Oh, that sounds good.
And yeah, I did go to the Scala a few times when it was still a cinema.
I mean, me as a person who I'm developing screenplays, I've sort of retrained from a journalist to screenwriting, and you look at someone like Schrader as a hero, and then you go,
he wrote Taxi Driver when he was living in a car.
That's what I was going to say. You go, what was the secret behind, like, why Taxi Driver is so powerful? You go, he was living out of his car, and I can't replicate that.
I think it's because Schrader, Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro and Harvey Keitel were all at a point where they were pushing to be successful, to make it, but also pushing to be able to be successful and make it doing what they were good at.
It was a peak of New Hollywood, wasn't it, as well, in the 70s, 76?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the Raging Bulls book, as Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, is really well identified and documented that period. But as a viewer, as somebody going to watch that film, you can sense that how desperation fuels the perfect performances of each of them. And I mean, obviously the three key characters have all been together before. The director and Keitel and De Niro have all been together in Mean Streets before that. But I mean, you watch these films and they're like, they're obviously very competent films, but Scorsese was brilliant at using the city to fill up his film. You know, there's no quiet moments in Taxi Driver. The scene is frequently, it's a busy scene. You know, what you're seeing in front of you, the set is busy. And whether that's because he's surrounded by 1,000 people walking down the streets of New York, or whether it's because he's in the in his apartment. And the first time it slows up is after when it goes into slow-mo after he's, when he tries to kill himself after he's shot. The pimps and the Johns in the brothel. You know, I haven't watched it for a while. My son studies film now, and I watched it with him. And there's a great documentary about it. You know, I mean, obviously nowadays there's so much more information about these films retrospectively on screen and on books and retrospective articles and so on. But at the time, I think throughout that time of my mid-teens to my mid-20s, I was just desperate to find out about things that I was really into. Whether that was Hunter Thompson or Tom Wolfe, the writers, or Taxi Driver. You know, I guess in a way, the fact that it wasn't easy to get information meant you were keener in the search.
I think so. I can't imagine it's not. I mean, you can be now. You could be rockabilly today. You can be reggae tomorrow. You can be goth the day after that, and it doesn't. You know, it doesn't require much effort. Whereas, if you tie your colours to any mast, that's you. So you end up diving into it for as much as you can.
Well, a good example is, you know, two nights ago I watched Copland, directed by James Mangold. Starring Harvey Keitel and De Niro, they're both on this, you know, in that as well. And you know, before the film had even finished, I was reading an interview with Mangold where he was talking about it in depth.
Yeah,
that was as the film was going on. You know,
no, I hate myself when I do that.
Yeah, it was exact opposite back then. And so just to come back round again, you know, the NME was one of the few places where you could open it up on a Wednesday. And there might be a dirty, great, big full-page photograph of Travis Bickle or you know, I remember seeing big pictures of Mad Max when that came out, and the Enemy made films look exciting, even though obviously it was a music paper. They used the graphics of those films to make the magazine look good.
Absolutely.
And that was something that I took into Loaded. I knew that I wanted to have loads and loads of pictures of the films that I loved, like Get Carter and The Italian Job and With Nail and so on. I understood that. I knew that the pictures existed of films. I knew that the world of cinema would make the magazine look good. Yeah. You know, so we deliberately often used, you know, stills from films. And later on, the next film we're going to talk about, when I had a movie mag called Hot Dog, because it was proving hard or expensive to get shots that weren't the same old press shots of With Nail, I actually bought an actual copy of the film.
Well, let's start there. So let's talk about the third choice is With Nail and I from 1987. Funny enough, I had Alistair Owen, who wrote Smoking in Bed, Conversations with Bruce Robinson. He's just done the same thing you're doing now, the three films. I did it with him last week. But let's talk about what With Nail and I means for you.
I enjoyed that book. I thought it was a great book. I only read that this year.
Okay.
I don't know. I think it had been out a while, but I saw it and I bought that. I thought it was really good. But yeah, so when I had Hot Dog, I actually, basically there were about two or three shots in existence from With Nail that were used as press shots. And when I had Hot Dog, we found a copy for sale and bought it and cut it up. It was a really tatty, rough copy from Belgium or somewhere. And it was, we got it on early eBay. And it meant that in Hot Dog, we had shots that other people had never had.
Seriously?
We it was about 50 quid or something. but going back to 1987, when With Nail came out, I just joined the NME and I did see that at the cinema.
Mm.
I saw it at a cinema, I think in Soho. And I had a mate on the NME, Adrian Tierney-Jones, and he actually looked like With Nail. I remember being at a house party at the time when it was on release. And he had his hair slicked back and a long coat. And, you know, he didn't look like it because he wanted to look like Richard E. Grant's character, just what Adrian looked like. He was a sub on the NME. I can remember fighting our way up the stairs to get to the bit where the drink was in the kitchen and some guy going, With Nail! that struck a chord straight away, again, because it looked so great and it was so well acted and so well written. And it was a brilliant film about the loneliness of being a young man. And obviously they have their friendship. But I'm talking about at the end. And I watched With Nail. The films that I used to watch an awful lot between The Enemy and Loaded were Performance and With Nail.
Okay.
They're the two films that I used to have on video, and I'd go home drunk and put them on. Or if anyone was round, you know, I've had a girl around or something, they'd put that on in the background. Or if I had mates round and we were just talking, whatever, I'd just turn those two on. And so With Nail was always rolling in my living room. And so when Loaded came out and I knew I wanted to have cult film content in it, I wrote a piece called With Nail, You Terrible Cult. And no one had ever written that piece. It was the first time anyone had said, okay, it's 7 years since this film came out and it's become much bigger now as a video film where people watch it and quote it to each other. It's become a much bigger cult than it had been on release. And that really struck a chord. And I know somebody, when I got in touch with Bruce Robinson to interview him, he was really appreciative, you know, that there was a generation that loved the film because it, you know, he's never happy, Bruce.
No.
And he wasn't happy with the way it was produced in the end and the way that they cut it. And, you know, there was a falling out, a handmaid. And then, you know, he probably wished in Britain more people had seen it. I think quite a lot of people saw it in the States. So it was really great to be able to interview him. And we ran that piece. So consequently, because of that piece, you know, I was interviewed for the making of documentary and things like that, just to talk about from the viewer's experience.
Yeah.
But the Windmill drinking game already existed at that point. You know, when I was talking about it, one of the guys in the office said, oh, my mates play a drinking game. And that was something that already existed. So he put that in as well. I just think, you know, I kind of felt before Loaded came out, I think if Loaded hadn't happened, I would have identified how Withnail felt at the end, you know, like he had a talent that wasn't given an opportunity to find its destiny, or, you know, he didn't have a way to use his talent. And I asked Bruce once later on, he had a screening at the South Bank and he did a Q&A. And I said, I didn't feel like the end was the right ending. I didn't ask him this when I interviewed him.
Right.
I said, was that really the end? And he said, no, you're right.
Go
he
on.
Said, in the script, he goes back to the house and he takes the shotgun and the really expensive bottle of wine that he's stolen from Monty's house.
Yeah.
And he fills the both barrels up with wine and he shoots himself.
Really?
Not for a drink. He kills himself.
Oh, no, of course not. I figured that's what you meant. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Obviously, if you poured wine down a shotgun, I don't imagine the shot would work. But and that was his original ending.
Wow, I never knew that.
So I think, yeah, and then over the years I've been to see Bruce, you know.
Can I ask you, you know, watching the film in 1987 when it's very much the 80s, and obviously this is a period piece. What did you remember your relationship being to the 60s? You know, like, because obviously nostalgia. It was still a new thing in pop culture, really. In 1987, we're just about to hit acid house, aren't we, in house music? So that's kind of the last real new cycle of music, isn't it?
Yeah, well, because it was a film,
yeah.
It didn't matter because, I mean, loads of films that I loved were from different periods, you know, Quadrophenia, Butch and Sundance, you know, Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
The idea of moving back in time in films was different to the idea of moving back in time in music. You know, there's a sense in music that you always need to be on the new thing. And you're right, at that time there wasn't, you know, there was an emergence of a new generation of music in sort of bands, and then also the emergence of sort of DJ culture and house music and the Balearic scene. So it just felt quite natural, you know. I mean, like, another film that I love was Once Upon a A Fistful of Dynamite.
Okay.
You know, and that, you know, that was fun. But like A Fistful of Dynamite and like Taxi Driver, Withnail has a beautifully haunting soundtrack. And it was interesting finding out that was by David Dundas, who had the big hit, My Blue Jeans On. I've Got My Blue Jeans On.
Yeah, yeah, I know the tune.
Yes, that was David Dundas. And then also, I don't know if I mentioned this in my piece, but I think Bruce told me when I interviewed him that David Dundas had written the da 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 da, like the little music that went with the logo for the ident music for Channel 4.
Right.
And he'd retained the rights. So consequently, he was getting a broadcasting royalty something like 40 times a day.
Jesus.
He was getting more royalty checks than anyone else, Lord David Dundas. And I think there was a lot going on, as there was in Taxi Driver, there was a lot going on in Withnail. You know, there was the look, there was the sense of desperation. You can feel the keenness. There's no slack in those films.
No. But equally, they do both give you time to breathe. You know, you get to feel the mood as well as the action, don't you? You kind of, it's not just about the freneticness, but you don't feel like it stood still ever, do you?
No, never. And I think, you know, sometimes you watch a film and what I find when I watch films now, I become very critical of the editing.
Right.
And I don't know how to edit a film, but I know how to edit an article and I know how to edit, you know, a magazine and things. But I think you just see periods of film and you think, fucking cut all this out. You know, it's not serving a purpose. And I think I was glad when my book came out that people started saying similar comments to me, that it was fast and that you never felt like you wanted to put it down, or, you know, you kind of just speeds you through. People were saying to me, I've read it in 2 days, a weekend, or three nights, or whatever. And I was like, part of me was frustrated with that because it took 6 years to write. But and I think, you know, if you look at films, if you look at your favourite films, there's probably not much wasted time on screen. You know, like I said, I watched King of Comedy the other day, and it was just came across it on that Rakuten thing that you get with your Samsung telly. Mm. And my girlfriend had never seen it, so we started watching that couple of minutes in when she joined, and it's just it's so tight. You know, every scene in those films moves you on.
Mm.
You know, and I think that was what was good about Withnail. You know, obviously it's when they go off to Crow Crag, that gives them somewhere to physically go and to move it to a different location, which is what probably separates it from being like the Lightly Lads or something where they're just stuck in one place. But yeah, just beautifully written, so well shot, great colours, great soundtrack.
Well, look, we're out of time, James. We've way gone past our 5 minutes of film, but it was great. It's been great to talk about them. No time wasted on that matter. Just going to remind people. So your three films that impacted everything in your adult life: National Lampoon's Animal House, Taxi Driver, Withnail and I. Animal House, your memoir that's out now. Who's a publisher?
It's by Quercus, but I'll give you the order of cheapness to get it.
Go on.
Cheapest is Audible, which is about, I think, £7 and has been hugely popular. It's sold well over 1,000 copies.
Are you reading it?
I read it myself and I keep breaking down in laughter how stupid some of the things we did at Loaded were. And that, unintentionally, that's become a bit of a selling point. So that's the cheapest. And then Kindle is doing well. And then you can get it from Amazon. Obviously, they'll get it to you the next day. And they will deliver it. And then all the independent bookshops, a lot of them have it. And then you can buy it at Waterstones online. Or if you want a signed copy and a dedicated copy, you can just follow me on social media at James Brown. I've sold about 400.
Oh, well.
I've sold over 400. There was a delay in Waterstones sending them out and rough trade. So people, I just said, oh, look, cancel it and send it to me. I'll dedicate and sign one. And then I just had hundreds of people asking for them. So that's £25, but you know.
Well, look, it just gives me to say thank you very much for giving your time on the Britflix podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's a pleasure. I love talking about films, and I'm looking forward to making one.
I hope you do. There's plenty of raw material to deal with.
Yeah. Thank you, Stuart.
My
it's
pleasure.
It's been a great podcast.
Another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.